Good evening, everyone. We're going to continue in Genesis chapter 1. Last time we started with the first verse and we talked about the different words within it and what they meant. We also talked about the first day, and that was as far as we got. We'll see if we can get at least two more days this evening, but we'll see how it goes. My computer is dying on me, so I wasn't able to print off my paper into big letters. So I scribbled it down. My handwriting is not as good as my typing. So if I start staring at the paper real hard, you'll know that I'm trying to read my own writing, and we'll just go from there. I also brought me something to drink. If Samantha's looking for the tea, I have it. Okay. Last week we talked about day one and how God created everything with having nothing in His hands besides just His words. He spoke it into existence. He spoke the light into existence. He also spoke time, which is the beginning. He spoke space into existence, and He spoke matter into existence, the heavens and the earth. And then He finished that one day, and we're going to look at some other days this evening. Let's take a little sidestep first, and let's talk about a couple of things. One is going to be in between day one and day two. I'm not talking about the gap theory anymore. We're moving on. I think Bert went ahead and finished that for me, so I don't have to keep on talking about that anymore. We're going to leave Schofield out tonight. We may mention him if we get far enough, but we're not going to attack him. So one of the sidebars is what we're talking about in Genesis chapter 1 is what they call origin science. It's one of those things, it's not testable. It's really not provable. We have the evidence that is there, but that's all we have. You can't go to the science lab and recreate the beginning. We just have to go by what we have in our hands, which is the scriptures. The evolutionists have the evidence the same as we do. They just come to a different conclusion of how everything began. So this is what we're talking about is origin science. Last time I spoke, a lot of times I would say probably or possibly or maybe, and that's what origin science is. It's possibly, it's probably, and it's maybe. And we're looking at it from God's perspective, so we're going by what we think may have happened in the beginning as far as what the creationist scientists say, what the scriptures say, not just in the book of Genesis. We discussed last Wednesday, some of the men were together, and we talked about the book of Job. The book of Psalms talks about creation. Revelation talks about the beginning a little bit, and it also talks about the future. So we take all of these scriptures, and that's how we have our biblical glasses of what happened in the beginning. So origin science is not, it's not provable to the point that you can take it into a lab and then show exactly what happened in the past, but we can look at the evidence and come to some conclusions. The second sidebar I want to talk about is what happened between day one and day two. Possibly. We don't know for sure, but this is what I would think, and this is what some of the other commentators are thinking. Between day one and day two, Henry Morris is one of those. He taught that this was when the angels were created. They haven't always existed. Angels are not eternal, so they had to be created at some point. Were they created before the heavens and the earth, or were they created before the earth was made, as far as the land mass that we're going to talk about tonight? So we're going to read a couple of verses, and then we're going to give a probable conclusion, but you can come up with your own ideas. We're going to start with Job chapter 38, and this is just our sidebar. So Job 38, verses 4 and through 7. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurement? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. So that's where we're going to stop at, is number 7. And it's talking about the morning stars, and it's talking about the sons of God. And most commentators would say that this is referring not to literal stars, but to the angels of God. Let's look at Psalm 104. Verses 2 through 5. Who cover yourself with light as with a garment, who stretch out the heavens like a curtain. He lays the beams of his upper chambers in the waters, who makes the clouds his chariot, who walks on the wings of the wind, who makes his angel spirits, his ministers, a flame of fire. Verse 5. you who lay the foundations of the earth, so that it should not be moved forever. So again, he's talking about the angels and how they were created. Hebrews chapter 1. And verse 14. And this is referring to the angels. Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister to those who will inherit salvation? So, with those verses and a couple other verses that were mentioned, the conclusion is that the angels were created for human beings as far as our guardian angels. They were here, sent here to minister to those who are to inherit salvation. So, what the commentators are saying is that they were created after day one, but before day two, before the land mass was formed out of the waters. And we'll talk about that as soon as we get done with our sidebar. So probably, possibly, maybe the angels were created between day one and day two. And if you don't agree with that, that's fine. We can have other discussions about that as well. So let's go on to verses 6 through 8 of day 2, Genesis chapter 1. Verse 6, then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, so the evening and the morning were the second day. So what we're going to talk about tonight is the firmament. And if you notice what God does, he speaks and it comes into existence. All things are from God. So firmament basically means expanse, stretched out thinness, heaven, space, or atmosphere. This is basically the same word that's used with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Remember what we talked about last time. Depending on the context, that's how we interpret a certain word. Day in the context of Genesis chapter 1 usually means a literal 24-hour day. Heaven can mean the vast space and outer space. It could also mean one particular dimension as far as what we see. So the expanse or the firmament is the heaven that we can see as far as where we see our clouds, where we see everything above us. All right, let's go and look at the waters above. And again, we're going to do a possibly, probably, or maybe on this one. Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament and the waters which were above the firmament. The waters above the firmament, again, the commentators give different views. Some of them say this is a canopy of actual material, water, or a frozen canopy that was protecting the primeval earth. Some say that it was a water vapor that was above the sky that we see that was protecting the earth. So there's different views on it. I lean toward what Dr. Moore says as far as the water vapor. And we'll talk about that as we get into Genesis chapter 3, and especially when we talk about the flood that's going to be coming up in the future chapters. So what was it? We're not really sure. We weren't there. This is origin science. So I'm going to say that this is a water vapor. What would be some of the benefits? Now remember, when God's creating, he's always saying it was good. Then on verse 31, he says it was very good. So we see a lot of things today that are not very good. We see skin cancer if we stay out in the sun too much. We see wrinkles on our faces when the sun gets on us too much. We see, especially with Abby, light skin, and my wife with light skin, you get sunburn if you stay out in the sun too much. Did the water vapor protect those people back then and all of creation back then? Some of the benefits that are possible from a water vapor canopy would be a uniform temperature, uniform humidity, the perfect environment for life, basically. And I read this one. Somebody, I think Neil had mentioned this one about the hyperbaric chamber. You talked about that. This is one of those hyperbaric chamber effects. And I read some of this, and he had talked about a snake losing its venom in the hyperbaric chamber, so I had to look it up and see what was going on. If you don't know, I love reptiles, and we'll talk about that when we get to Genesis chapter, when we get into the sixth day. So I was reading some of that stuff, and what would be the benefits of a hyperbaric chamber effect? And if you look at it, it would be more pressure, it would be more oxygen, some better nutrients than what we have today. So this would produce a longer life, healthier people, healthier plants. Everything would be benefited from that. And talking about what me and Neil were talking about, Dr. Carl Ball, he built a hyperbaric chamber down in Texas. Okay. And he's also got a theme park. No, it's just a park. Genesis Park, that it was called. Okay. So it's a Genesis Park, but he built a hyperbaric chamber, and he basically tried to recreate what was taking place in the Garden of Eden. And he was able to take a copperhead venomous snake and put it in that chamber for a little while, and the venom lost its toxicity. It became a non-venomous snake by being in that hyperbaric chamber. So we can sort of imagine this vapor canopy around the creation, being protecting everything, and how pure and how perfect it would be if we could go back to that state. Of course, we can't right now, but you see the effects of it. If we can reproduce that in a small detail and make a venomous snake turn into a non-venomous snake for a period of time, even if it's only for a day or two, just imagine what it was like during the beginning with no venomous snakes, no death, no suffering, no skin cancer, no any type of sickness. So that would be some of the benefits of the water vapor above the firmament. And this firmament, because we're going to be talking about another one when we get to the stars, this firmament is what we see. As far as when we look out in the sky, we see the blue skies, we see the clouds. That's the firmament that this is referring to. It's not referring to the vast outer space, which is also called the firmament or called heaven. It's just talking about this particular place right there. Let's read a couple of verses and maybe this will reinforce this idea. Isaiah chapter 40. Verse 22. It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. So the concept of the firmament is like a tent, a stretched out thinness going across the waters below, and we're going to talk about the earth in a little bit. Job chapter 26. In verse 10, it drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. So again, he's talking about this spherical shape, this round shape of the earth, and how God created everything exactly how he wanted it. There's a lot of probable, possible, maybe things that happened after the fall of man, but we're not going to get into that right now. We're just going to talk about what God created. And he created the earth in a specific, purposeful way. He made it exactly the way it was in the beginning so that it could be inhabited. Our planet is unique within our solar system, within this galaxy, within the universe, within all of creation. This one planet stands out unique among all the rest. Probably millions of stars. I don't know how many galaxies and universes and all of these other creations that are out there. And here we are, this one speck within the cosmos, and there's life here. The scientists are struggling to find life on Mars and Jupiter and the moon and wherever else they're looking for, and they can't find life, and life is right here. And they're saying that it has to be life in another planet because all of us evolved millions of years, so there has to be some kind of planet. We don't care if it's millions of light years away, but there has to be another planet with more life. There has to be because we all evolved. And this is what we are up against when we look at the Scriptures. The Scriptures don't say anything about any other life forms besides what's on this earth and the angels and then God himself. So if we're looking for other life forms, what fascinates me is we haven't even found all of the life that's on this earth. Every day we're finding new species, new birds, new plants, new insects, new reptiles. We're finding all of these new animals, and yet they're still saying that there's got to be life out there. We don't even know how much life is right here. There could still be dinosaurs on this earth, and we don't know. But they're saying it can't be any dinosaurs on this earth because what happened to them? They went extinct millions of years before mankind came on the earth. So we have all of these questions from our scientists, and yet the Bible has the answers. So God forms the waters. He separates them. He puts the firmament in the middle of the waters. And then he starts doing some new things. When he finishes day two, he says those very familiar words, the evening and the morning, or the second day, and it was good. He finishes up, well, he doesn't say it was good right here, but he does say it was the evening and the morning were the second day. And always remember, evening plus morning plus a day, what means what? 24 hours. If we take it literally like it says, we'll always come up with that answer in this context. All right, let's go to verse 9, and we're going to talk about day 3. Day 3, two things is separated, and two things take place. Let's read the verses 9 through 13. Then God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And then God said, Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the third day." So now let's look at what happens to the waters under the firmament. The waters above the firmament are basically just sitting there as a type of canopy, protecting the primeval creation. And now we're talking about the waters under the earth, or under the heavens. "We gather together into one place and let the dry land appear." Into one place, commentators say the one place could be one place, or it could mean that all of them are connected in some way. I would lean toward it being all connected in some way. When we talk about the Genesis flood and we see what takes place there, we talk about the earth is broken up, the waters gush forth from the earth, and then we're also going to talk about the waters coming down from the heavens. Right now there's no rain, and we're going to talk about that when we get to some more of the other verses. So there's no rain. The waters are there. They're being brought together into seas. And now we're looking at them as being connected and yet being plural seas. So they're connected up with these subterranean channels, these rivers up under the land. How do we get caves? Caves usually formed by water running under the ground. How do we get valleys and canyons? Well, water running above the ground and cuts into the grooves of the earth. So the waters are connected. They're plural seas, but they're also singular, meaning that they're connected under the grounds. So we're going to talk about that in next chapters coming up. So now let's look at the earth. "And let the dry land appear, and it was so, and God called the dry land earth." Now, it already said that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and remember, context rules and how we determine what something means. When God said, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," he's talking about the general earth, the general heavens. Now he's talking about a specific land mass, and he's getting more specific as he goes through these things. He starts with a general overview. He creates everything through his word, and then he's getting specific in what he's doing. So this is what he's talking about now, the earth or the dry land. "And the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good." Let's look at Psalm 102. Verse 25. "Of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands." Now don't get confused because he says of old. It doesn't mean millions of years. It just means time past. Psalm 95. verse 5. The sea is His, for He made it, and His hands formed the dry land. And one more verse, Isaiah 48. And verse 13, indeed, my hand has laid the foundation of the earth, and my right hand has stretched out the heavens. When I call to them, they stand up together. So again, this is emphasizing that God created not only the waters, but He also created the dry land, and He formed them exactly the way He wanted. The book of Job, if you haven't read through it lately, read through it, and it talks about He was the only one there. The angels are there watching, but God's the one creating, and He's not asking questions. Do you think when me and Samantha are moving things around, before I stop moving and sit down and rest, I have to ask her, well, what do you think? I have to make sure that it's okay with her. I have to get her approval of what I'm doing as far as in the house. Anything that I'm doing, I want somebody's approval, making sure that I'm doing everything okay. God has an audience when He's creating the earth. He's forming the land. He's making the plants. He's making the animals. But He never asks them, well, what do you think, guys? Am I doing a good job? Would you change something about that? Would you make it differently? God doesn't ask any question. He just does. He just speaks it into existence, and the angels stand there in awe. And it causes them to worship. It causes them to see the majesty of God. When we look at this creation, we see it through tainted eyes. We don't see fully what God created in the beginning. Even when we look at it today, and we're going to talk about the plants some, even when we look at what we see today, it still causes us to be in awe of God when we see some of His creation. And we're looking at it through fallen eyes. We're looking at it through deception, through sin. And yet we still see the majesty and the power of God through the effects of the fall of man. So just imagine if you saw it through untainted eyes, with no sin, with no suffering, with no deception or anything. Just imagine what you would be seeing. And we have a glimpse of it in the first chapter, but we still cannot comprehend it. Verses 11 through 13 is the plant life or the vegetation. It talks about the grasses, the herbs, and the trees. Again, a probable, possible, maybe understanding of this would be that He created things with age, maturity, so that they could produce the seeds and the fruits already. You didn't have to plant the seed. You didn't have to wait for it to grow. They were just made in adult sizes. When we look at Adam and Eve, and we talk about them in the upcoming lessons, we'll see that they were created not as children, but as adult size. What age that means, I don't know, but they were adult size. They were able to reproduce. Let's do a little sidebar as far as kinds, the word kinds. When I was studying this, it was fascinating me because I never went to college for biology or anything, but I wish I had because I love science so much, especially the biological sciences. And when you look at God's creation and you see things and you see how He made things, and it's just awesome to understand that there was one God spoken into existence with no help from anybody. And a lot of times when we're putting things together, we need help. Somebody hold this for me. Somebody read the directions for me. Because you know me and we don't read directions. We just look at pictures. So we have to go through all of these things. And yet God was there in His infinite wisdom and created out of nothing. So kinds. What does kinds mean? I don't think it means species, and I'll tell you why. I'm not going to get into detail because I might be wrong on some of the stuff. Again, possible, probable, maybe. Let's read the verses. Then God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind. And we'll see this repeated throughout the first chapter. If it means species like we understand it today, then we have a problem. And I'm going to use reptiles for an example because I love reptiles, and that's what I'm going to talk about. There are some snakes that can interbreed, but yet they are two distinct species. If we're talking about species, what's the underlying theme of what we just read? It says, after its kind, after his kind. And what that is saying is the two kinds can't mix. Well, two species, depending on what the species are, they can actually mix and hybridize or have babies. So if it's species, then we have problems, especially when we start thinking about what the evolutionists believe. They believe that men came from ape-like creatures. Well, if the species are the same and the subspecies are different, then they can interbreed. If the two species are different, then it's possible that they can hybridize. I was reading some article, I can't remember where it was. It might have been in one of the ICR publications, talking about a scientist over in one of the European countries was trying to hybridize apes and human beings. And it depended on if you were of African descent, then they were going to try and get you with a chimpanzee or an ape or something. I'll have to bring the article next time I teach and show it to you. But they're basically saying we're all animals anyway. There's got to be some way we can get together and produce this humanoid creature that can overcome the world. And that's what they're trying to do. So kinds. Let's get the definition of what kinds is. And this is the biblical definition. A group of organisms who share a genetic relationship through common descent from an organism originally created by God during creation week. So this is the biblical understanding of kinds. We're all related within that group of kind. We're not all related within that group of species. So we're making a distinction, and the distinction is basically being drawn between the evolutionary understanding and the creationist understanding. The creationist understanding says that within that kind there is a possibility to have babies and reproduce and so forth. The evolutionary thing is we're all advancing upwards. Some's going to die out. Some's going to mature. Some's going to change into another creation. So this is what we're up against. There is variation within a kind, but there is never any horizontal change or vertical change. So what that means is, if we're all on the same line, the coyote, the dingo, the wolf, the sheepdog, the chihuahua, poodle, whatever you want to say, if they're all on the same line, they're all dogs. They can still mix, they can still breed, they can produce mutts and the new genetic thing, as we want to call some of them that are out there, the hairless dog and what some of these others that are out there. An English bulldog is a worthless animal. They can't have babies naturally. I used to work at a veterinary hospital. They all have to have a C-section, which tells me if you leave them to themselves, they're going to die out. They need humans' help. We created the English bulldog. Now we have to keep it going because they have to have a C-section. They can't have natural birth, which is pretty funny. All right, let's go on. So variation within the kind. Another kind would be humanity. We all came from who? Adam and Eve. So all of us are within this one kind, starting from these two people. This one organism, if you want to call it that. Adam and Eve. Then they produce, and they produce, and they produce, and you got this long lineage right here. Some of them are tall, some of them are short, some of them are a little bit heavy, some of them are a little bit too skinny, anorexic. Some of them can't walk. Some of them can't see. Now, not in the beginning. In the beginning, when humans were born, they were born perfectly healthy. After this is what we're talking about. After the fall of man, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but within this created kind, you get all different colors of skin, of eye color, hair color, eye shape, ear shape, nose shape, lip shape, height, everything. All these variations within that one kind, because we all came from Adam and Eve. So that's these kinds that are being talking about. So within that one kind, there's all the genetics that are there for many types of variations within that one kind. But a human being did not evolve from an ape-like creature. A snake did not evolve from a lizard-like creature. They were created the way God wanted them to. Now we'll talk about the snake in Genesis chapter 3. And how it's not like it used to be, but it's definitely not a limbless lizard. All right, let's go ahead and look at some more stuff. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And this is going to emphasize the kinds. verses 38 and 39. But God gives it a body as he pleases, and to each seed its own body. All flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animals, another of fish, and another of birds. And then verse 40 talks about the celestial bodies and the terrestrial bodies. So what Paul, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is saying is that we are distinct. There's one flesh over here, there's one flesh over here, and they can't mix. This is totally contrary to what evolutionary teaching says. Evolutionary teaching says you are an animal. You're nothing more than an animal. You're going to die an animal. You might as well act like an animal. That's the whole bottom line of evolutionary thought. If you remember what Bert read, that one quote, G. Richard Bozar, I encourage you to look him up on the web and read all of his quotes, even just from that one magazine article. The man was an evolutionist. He was an atheist, but he knew exactly what he was saying concerning evolution. If you take away the reason for Jesus Christ coming on this earth, which is because of the fall of man, if you take that away, you destroy the gospel message. The reason why Jesus Christ had to come is because of Genesis chapter 3. Well, something took place in Genesis chapter 3 to mess up this perfect creation that God made. And G. Richard Bozarth understood the whole complex idea of evolution and what it does. If you accept evolution and what it does to Christianity, it totally destroys it. And that's why I was talking last time about the old age different theories, the gap theory, the day-age theory, all of these other, the framework hypothesis, all of these that are out there that are trying to compromise the scriptures and put evolution into those. If we compromise and we accept evolution as scientific fact, then we might as well take our Bibles and throw them out the door. You won't believe how many Christians that were out there who got wrapped up in evolution and now they're atheists. And there's one, I can't think of his name, but he used to go with Billy Graham everywhere. And he was an evangelist as well, and he turned away. He said, why is there death and suffering? Well, what about the age of the earth? He had all of these questions that the Bible answers, and he walked away because Billy Graham couldn't answer them. And this man, he turned away. Last I heard, when he died, he was still an unbeliever. He was very unhappy, very miserable, but he had turned away, all because of what evolutionary teaching does. And how many teachers do we have in here? I know we got one. How many other teachers? Our teachers should definitely, especially in the public schools, maybe not in the Christian schools, but in the public schools, you're definitely going to see the effects of evolutionary teaching. How many of our children are running wild with no respectful authority for the adults? Evolutionary teaching says the younger are better, the old, get them out of here, kill them. They're no good to us. They're holding us back. They're defeating the process of evolution. We need to get rid of them. That's the evolutionary concept. In with the new, out with the old. And when they say out with the old, they mean kill the old. Evolutionary concepts bring about, and Bert mentioned this, talk about racism. And we'll talk about that when we get to the Tower of Babel. What happened? Where did the races come from? So evolutionary thought brings about all of these drastic and bad things to mankind. We have it bad enough with the fall of man. We don't need something else to add on to the bad that is already in this earth. It just compounds on everything. So the kinds is a broader understanding than species. It can possibly mean species, but more than likely it's a broader term. There's one guy that's out now, and he wrote a book. It's called Biblical Classification of Life. It basically takes a biblical understanding of how we classify the kinds, and it does not use evolution in any way. It only uses the scriptures so that we as Christians, as believers, we can understand, well, what's the distinction between a Labrador and a poodle? Well, they're both the same. Well, what about the coyote? Or what about the African wild dog or the fox? Are they still within that kind? Possibly they can be. What about the cats? Are all tigers and lions and cheetahs and house cats, are they all grouped within that kind? So that book basically goes through and it tries to put a biblical understanding on what we see without using an evolutionary model. So let's go on. fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth. Again, if they're created as adult, mature trees and plants, then they're already ready to reproduce. And remember, God is setting up this place for the inhabitants. And day six concludes, and it shows us who his great pinnacle of creation was, and who would that be? Mankind. So God creates the waters above, the firmament, the waters below, the dry land, the plants, the seeds, the fruits, everything that mankind needs. And then he's going to produce other things for us. We haven't gotten to the animals yet, but if he created the animals first, and when they were first created, they weren't for food, what were they for? I think they would be for just for us to look at them, admire their creation, see how they work, and look to God and say, what a mighty God we serve, what an awesome God he is. Because when we see the creation, we see God's mighty hand. So we're going to stop there. I'm not going to get into our next days. I did finish up 2 days tonight, so that's pretty good. I encourage you to take the time when you go outside, just look up into the heavens and see the stars. I know we haven't talked about them being created yet, but just admire what God has done. And we're looking through tainted eyes. We're looking through sin-cursed concepts. And yet we can still see a glimpse of what God has done. He's sustaining the corrupt earth, the corrupt creation. He's sustaining it now. But just try and imagine what it looked like in the beginning. It looks so much better. When I take my glasses off, I can still see. I can see my wife, and she's still pretty. But when I put my glasses on, she looks a whole lot better. Not because there's anything wrong with her, but there's something wrong with me. I need the glasses. So me as a sinful person, corrupted by sin, the fall of man, when I look at God's creation, I don't see it clearly. But I can still say, she still looks good to me. I can squint, still looks good. So when I look at the creation through sin-cursed eyes, I can still say, I see God in this. I know God created this. There has to be a God. Only a fool would say there is no God. There has to be one. And then the Bible interprets the creation. You can see a creator in the creation, but we need to know about the one true God. This Yahweh, as we're going to find out next time I teach. This Elohim, this great creator, this all-sustaining, self-existent one. So then, when I look through the Bible, I can better imagine what his creation looked like. I can better imagine what Adam and Eve looked like before the fall of man. They had to look better than me. They had to be healthier than me. They had to be a whole lot happier than I am just in the situation that they were in. Now, I got joy within my heart because of Jesus Christ. But as far as physical ailments, sometimes I just feel like standing in the bed and never moving. So when we look through tainted eyes, we can cry out to God and we can say, you created me. You're going to sustain me, but I want to see you through those perfect glasses. I want to see you face to face. And we've been ruined by this fall of man, but we're going to be made perfect physically. We're already made spiritually perfect, but we're going to be made perfect physically one day. And that's what we're looking forward to. So next time we'll be on day 4.